The season finale of HBO's Lovecraft Country left us all shook up and confused. We're finally ready to confront our emotions on this episode of Pop Life.
Digital content on W8YR is supported by Hunter Springs Landscape Artisans, helping clients throughout the Central New York community create their own unique outdoor living space for 37 years. Services and project galleries found at hunterspringslandscape.com.
Welcome to Pop Life, the show that gets to the why behind your favorite pop trash. I'm Joe Lee. I don't know about you, but I'm dealing with some serious PTSD after the season finale of Lovecraft Country.
Magic is not something to be feared, but a gift to pass on.
This has never been personal.
What the hell it ain't? You're trying to kill my son.
This book belongs to our family. And together, we're gonna use it to protect our family.
We follow the trials, tribulations, and adventures of our protagonists throughout the season, and in the end, many of us were devastated, even confused by the choices of showrunner Misha Green and the writer's room. This episode of Pop Life, The Mark of Cain, which is the title of the last chapter of the novel Lovecraft Country, tries to make sense of it all by comparing and contrasting the final chapter of the book to the final two episodes of the show. To help me with my therapy and give us some idea of HBO's choices and potential show direction going forward, we welcome back to the show Matt Ruff, author of the novel Lovecraft Country, the original source material for the HBO show.
Well, welcome back to Pop Life. I thought it'd be a good opportunity to, now that it's been a couple of weeks since the HBO show finished, that we revisit with you maybe how the series went, some differences between the series and your book, get your thoughts on that, and perhaps look ahead to what the next iteration of the show could be. I think the last time you and I spoke, we were, I don't know, three episodes, maybe four episodes into the show. So we didn't cover a lot beyond that. Didn't want to spoil things for folks. Hopefully most people have seen the show or read your book. And so we won't be spoiling much, but there will be spoilers in here.
Yeah, so if you have not yet seen it, maybe hold off on listening to this until afterwards, but yes.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to do is actually to cross-promote the two. So for those that have seen the show but haven't read your book, there are some significant differences in the show's storytelling and your storytelling that I think fans of the show might find interesting, and vice versa. If you've read the book, but haven't seen the HBO show, there are some significant differences in storytelling that you might find very interesting. And for those of us that have watched and read, help make sense of everything that sort of went on. Because the last three episodes of this series were just phenomenal. It's right, really great storytelling. But there are some serious divergence in storytelling, right?
Oh yeah. And I enjoyed the changes and the differences a lot. And it was interesting because I had said this all along, but it's not until you see it that you're sure what you really believe. So I was pleased that it was actually true that I was not so territorial, that I had problems with major divergences from the storyline. I did have to watch a couple of the episodes twice, just because as much as I tried to watch without preconceptions of how the story would have to go, there were just some things that were so surprising to me that I'm like, okay, let me get the shock out of the way and now judge this on its own terms. And when I did that, I was perfectly fine with it. But I was, yeah, particularly the finale, which again, we don't want to spoil, but there were just some things that happened in that I would have never have imagined they could do. So,
Well, we are going to spoil it. So if folks haven't finished watching it, just tune out now. But the, one of the differences. So the title of this episode of my show is called The Mark of Cain, because that's the final chapter in the book. And that's where the most of the differences in the storytelling, to me, the most significant differences in storytelling, sure, happened between the Mark of Cain and I guess the last two episodes of the show.
Yeah, Rewind 1921 and Full Circle. Yeah. The last two episodes.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little about the differences there. One of the differences in the storytelling is there are both the show and the book have this sort of band of characters that are, you know, riding to save the day. But there are differences in those band of characters. In the book, we include the Freemasons crew along right. with the regular heroes of the book, and that's folks like Pirate Joe, Abdullah, Mortimer. They're getting with the main characters, Letty, Tick, Uncle George, Hippolyta, and even Ruby to go save the day. And in the show, it's more of the central characters getting together, right?
I mean, they kept the size of the core cast. Yeah, the Freemasons are one of the obvious omissions from the, mm-hmm. I mean, in the novel, I have basically the Black Freemasons serving as sort of a counterbalance to the white Sons of Adam, and I just thought that was kind of a cool juncture. But yeah, in the show, there's already so much going on. I can't fault them for trying to limit the character pool at least a little, particularly for the finale. So it's much more organized around just the members of the two families.
Right. And so in our own storytelling here, let's just recap sort of where we're going with this. So in the show, the two main the two main characters that are driving sort of the evil force there are Christina Braithwaite, who is a descendant of the Braithwaites, and Captain Lancaster,
yeah,
who is in both the show and the book. Christina is in a female form in the show, and it's more of a it's a son in your book.
Right, it's Caleb Braithwaite in the novel. Right.
Caleb Braithwaite in the novel. So essentially, give us the sort of the top line storyline of what our characters are faced with at the end of this story.
So basically, in both cases, it's sort of this culmination of the plans of the scheming of Braithwaite, and in the novel, it's basically he's just trying to kill off the bad guys, get the Book of Names, and then, you know, become the king of the warlocks, basically. And in the TV show, she wants to basically take revenge on Lancaster, who murdered her lover, and she's still looking for some kind of, you know, I think she's there. She just wants immortality so that she can experience life and everything that it has to offer forever and ever. And one of the differences there is that, yeah, I mean, I think that one of the similarities, but also the difference is like in the book, Braithwaite wants power and he never really got to the point where he had to decide what he would do with it when he had it. And I think that was just, it comes from having spent his life under the thumb of his father and just wanting to break free and not really thinking beyond what would happen once he did that. And Christina, it's interesting in the show, she's got this weird affect that makes you realize that she's probably not spent a whole lot of time around normal people. It's like she's been raised in a hothouse, so she's got this uncanny affect to her that really is not with Caleb in the novel. But there too, it's like she just wants to, again, I don't think she knows exactly what she wants, except that she just wants time to experience everything that the world has to offer that's been denied to her, and she wants unmitigated power, but again, without really deciding what she's going to do with it. So
and wants it at all cost. Or at any cost, I should say.
Well, and that's definitely a similarity between the two of them. And there's this point where she evokes this where they're saying, well, you're going to have to kill Atticus to get what you want, right? And she's like, and she gets annoyed as if, well, yes, but it's the only way that I can do it. And, you know, why are you making such a big deal of that, since it's obviously the... And Braithwaite in the book is the same way, where he's never quite that explicit about it, but I always assume that, yes, he's somebody who's willing to do whatever it takes to get what he wants and is remorseless about it, but tries to be a likable, nice person, you know, without contradicting that. So it's a similar sociopathy, but she's just a little more obviously weird about it, I think.
It's almost like saying, like she thinks you're saying that she'll need a ham sandwich to pull this off. You know, you have, like, to, well, have, yeah, you have to have a ham. So yeah, I just need a ham sandwich. Fine. And that's,
why are you giving me a hard time about that? Yeah, exactly.
and so that's that is the sort of the crux of the conflict in the storytelling, is obviously that we want our heroes to survive. And she needs Atticus's blood to pull this off. And
right.
So in both stories, Tick is the sacrificial lamb, and of course we're fighting against that. I think the scenery of where this stuff takes place, it might seem like it's insignificant, but I kind of find it significant. So in your book, it takes place at a country club, and we should say that Captain Lancaster is sort of like the head warlock of the Chicago Lodge, right?
Right. Yeah.
Right. In your book, Caleb Braithwaite wants to
unite all of the lodges around the country with himself as the head, and Lancaster wants that position too. So obviously, part of Braithwaite's plan is he's got to kill Lancaster off and all of his supporters, and that's right. What the plan is. And like, actually, in the book, the plan is that Atticus will survive that. It's like he's bringing Atticus as a fake sacrifice, but really, it's a Trojan horse just to get in there and wipe them out. And my characters add an additional twist where they remove Caleb Braithwaite from the equation as well. But the thought is that if they don't get rid of Caleb Braithwaite, eventually he's going to want to kill Atticus anyway. It's like, mm-hmm. He doesn't need to yet, but he's like this annoying relative who promises he'll go away if you give him what he wants. And you know, that's not true. So this is our chance.
And so the significance of the lodge, I guess, you know, all warlocks and secret society need some place to meet where
they can't
be interrupted. And this obviously takes place in a country club lodge in Chicago. And
partly, I just didn't want to have to travel cross country back to Arnhem to do it. And also, Artem in the novel is not totally destroyed when the thing goes wrong in the first chapter. So the lodge is still there, which means Braithwaite has a place to go back to when he's kicked out of Chicago and go back and start brooding about what he's going to do next. So
one of the interesting things about, you know, in the storytelling in both is that Ruby, through Braithwaite, whether it's Caleb or Christina, gets a potion and is able to transform into a white woman. Plays out differently in both. And in this case, it was used, in your book, used to her benefit to help the protagonists with their plan. In the show, works to her detriment because Christina kills her
and takes her place. Yeah. And so the show was a lot more brutal in a lot of ways, I think. And other readers have commented on this, like the book is really about, I was very careful not to make magic too powerful. And I took it for granted that the characters were basically, they were not trying to seize power. They were trying to survive long enough to make the people who are bugging them go away. They just wanted to be left alone, essentially. And to go beyond that was kind of not ever really in the cards. And part of that is because I was just very conscious of not wanting to warp history by giving them too much power.
Right.
I feel like the series leans much more into the, not just like into a much heavier revenge angle. Like the people who are mean to my protagonist in the novel do tend to come to bad ends, but they're not often fatal. In the TV show, you can pretty much guarantee if somebody is racist, they're either going to suffer very horribly or they're probably going to die. And I was fine with that change, but it does change the dynamic somewhat. And then I think the finale in particular is building towards this very big metaphorical statement about the transfer of power between generations and how Black folks are taking power back to themselves. And I think it works, but it's obviously a different message with a different payoff. And it comes at a higher cost in terms of the core protagonist group as well, that we lose a couple of people that we love.
Which raises the evil of Braithwaite, because in the show she is, I don't know if she's genuinely interested or just using Ruby, but they become lovers in a way through both herself and her persona as her assistant, and disposes of her like that, in order to move her plan along.
I mean, my read on that was that you know, she probably felt as genuine an affection for Ruby as she could, given that she's basically a sociopath. But right. But that's why you really don't want to get into an intimate relationship with a sociopath, because they lack that core ability to forgive you for a slight. And once they realize you're working against them, yeah, they'll kill you at the drop of a hat. And so,
So in the show, Christina Braithwaite uses Ruby's image or her
physical, becomes her basically to yeah to, yes, to insinuate to herself in the family,
right.
Yeah,
and to infiltrate the group and discover their plans and alter their plans. In your book, very interesting use of this magic and power to make a statement on how easy it is to be a human being, a white human being in our society. And so Ruby, as we get to know her in your book, is using this potion to turn herself white, to see how the other half lives, to chase the dreams that she's always wanted to chase. And then she uses that also as power to help our group infiltrate the country club. Yeah, talk a little bit about why you designed that power and gave that to a black woman.
I mean, initially it was basically to solve this logistical problem, because in the book I basically decided that all the viewpoint characters are going to be black. And because it just made sense to me, if you're writing a story about the horrors of racism, I want to keep the focus on the characters for whom it is a horror. And I just didn't need really, and Caleb Braithwaite is transparent enough in the novel that you don't really need to see inside his head. You can figure him out if you're not blinded by his charisma. But it did create this logistical problem where I needed a way to show what the white villains were up to when they thought they were not being observed by my protagonist. And so I like, well, obviously I can do a Jekyll and Hyde story, and then who do I do that with? And Ruby was an interesting choice for me because she was this hardworking woman. You know, she was probably resentful of her sister, her younger sister, who gets this free mansion, basically. And so I thought, and she's the idea of, obviously, if you have somebody turning white, that becomes also a metaphor for passing. And I thought it was interesting to give that opportunity to a darker skinned black woman who would not have been able to even dream of passing as white without the use of magic. I just thought that might make the temptation a bit stronger. So mm-hmm. That was the initial thing, was just picking that because I needed a camera in the room when stuff was going on. But as soon as I gave it to her, she immediately became a very important character in the novel. Her chapter is, you know, probably the second longest in the novel. And I just found her relationship with Braithwaite in the novel was really interesting. And so that was, it just became an interesting exploration of the morality of it, and a weird inversion of the Jekyll and Hyde tale, because of course in the original Jekyll and Hyde, it's like, Jekyll creates the persona of Hyde so that he can sin without consequence. Whereas mm-hmm. in Ruby's case, she accepts the new form, not because she has any personal problem with being a black woman, but just she wants to have the freedom to pursue, what a white person would consider a totally normal life. She just right. wants to be free of that restriction, and the sin lies in what she's got to do to get it.
And that's a theme that I think Misha Green really explored more so than you did in the novel, because they can do that through images, you know, the night out at the club, and just sort of what it was like for a black woman to all of a sudden become a white woman and move freely through society without all the barriers and all the pushback that you would normally get. We could sort of experience that with her more through those pictures and through that storytelling.
Visually there were definitely some things they did that captured it really well. Whereas in the novel, I was being more understated about it. I think they also, though, they pursued it in somewhat different ways. Again, there was more of a revenge element in the TV show that I did not pursue so much in the novel, in part because I was just always wary of, I feel like revenge is in a way a luxury that you sort of have to be in a place of safety before you really start considering it. Whereas most people, when they're in a risky situation, their focus is going to be on survival. So I don't know. I think I made different moral choices in my Ruby made somewhat different moral choices than Misha's did. And mm-hmm. both journeys are interesting, but they are very different in certain ways. So
yeah.
And which is another reason to maybe explore both stories and see which one resonates better with you, or maybe they both do in different ways. So,
right. So when we get to Full Circle, final episode of the show, like in the Mark of Cain, the protagonists have this band of allies, but there are new characters, different characters that are introduced, or characters that are the same, but are
imagined
sort of,
very differently. Montrose being an obvious example.
Exactly. Montrose, as well as Hippolyta. As Hippolyta is in the show, really starting what, take on the persona of Orinthia Blue.
Yeah, that's definitely, again, the power level is much higher. Mm-hmm. And I love the blue hair, although that was one of those things where I'm like, wow, is she gonna walk around, 1950 Chicago like that? That would be quite a look to sport at that time period.
So I can imagine that in a future season that, yeah, she will begin to sort of just take on this Orinthia Blue persona. There's also the addition of a character that is not in the book.
Gia.
What are your thoughts on that character?
I loved her. I mean, that was that was the point where the series really began to move into its own territory and really depart from the novel. And I loved both the concept in general and then the way they did the sixth episode, that they were not afraid to start it as if it were an entirely different show. And it's like, mm-hmm. I knew that Atticus would eventually show up, but I think for the uninitiated, it'd be like, what happened to the core cast? What are we doing here? Mm-hmm. The fact that you actually had to wait 10 or 15 minutes before they finally tied it back into the main narrative, I thought was great.
So I
really enjoyed that whole thing and was curious to see how they were going to integrate it and use it in the rest of the season. So
just to remind folks that have read the book but haven't seen the show, this new character in the show, Jiha, played by Jamie Chung, who is a Kumio, a nine-tail fox spirit who, as told in the show, must kill like 100 men to become human again.
Yeah.
Sort of like a succubus, you think?
Yes, kill them in a very graphic sexual way.
And so this is someone that Atticus was seeing when he was in the Korean War.
And just barely avoided becoming victim number 100. Yes.
Barely avoided, because I guess she felt, didn't know she could feel for a man and felt for him. So he narrowly escaped. We jump forward in time. She comes to visit him to tell him of the vision she had of him dying. She comes to Chicago to tell him this. There's an episode where she appears and then she's gone again, and then doesn't appear again until Atticus goes to get her help in fighting Christina Braithwaite, if I'm remembering correctly. I'm trying not to have the same problem I had watching Game of Thrones and reading the Game of Thrones books at the same time, because things are getting mixed up.
I do pity the people who try to do both at once, because I remember the first time I was on set visiting the production, and I would talk to one of the producers, just like, yeah, I started reading your book, and then I had to stop because I couldn't. It was just close enough to totally confuse me in terms of trying to follow the action of both at the same time. Mm-hmm. He's constantly calling her, so she's mm-hmm. still there, but it's, yeah, she doesn't show up until very near the end, and then she just suddenly arrives in Chicago. And
right. Before I go where I wanted to go, which was to sort of talk about this core group of characters that I think they're creating to move into another season,
right,
I wanted to jump back and get your thoughts on Jigga Bobo, that episode, which I thought was extremely creative, really creepy storytelling.
Yeah.
What did you think of that? Because that's not, even though the curse that was put on Horus in the show is Diana, is the same. It just took on a different vision and tone.
Yeah, I think that, I was fine with the changes they made, and it was an mm-hmm. interesting variation that, again, I don't, I think that was just probably Misha having an interesting idea of using the characters from Uncle Tom's Cabin, just mm-hmm. sort of creeped out that, it was a variation on a theme. And I don't know if they did that just because they wanted to do something mm-hmm. visually different, or because the idea of a little doll chasing him would have just been kind of, or right. chasing her would have been a little too. Also, the other thing is that in the book, it takes a fair amount of setup there's the whole thing about this game club that, you know, Horus right. belongs to, that that's where the devil doll comes in. And this way it's just, nope, we just have the cover of Uncle Tom's Cabin and grab it from that and go from there. So, and there's so much else going on in these episodes that anything you can do to get a shorthand is definitely right. appreciated. And they were really creepy. So that was,
yeah, fine. They were, I mean, I think they pretty much took advantage of some modern day horror movie tropes, you know, with that kind of,
oh, sure. Little yeah. character. But that's
in the books, you, what was happening was these smaller figurines, even I think, maybe there was a lawn jockey even that was these.
Yeah,
these
it was a representation of Black Pete, who is the Dutch right. figure of Dutch Christmas. Yeah.
So why did you introduce that that piece of problematic?
I mean, I think I had already used a lawn jockey in a different chapter, so mm-hmm. I wanted something like that, and I needed a racist caricature that was also a figurine, and so I just created this fictional Dutch woman that Horace is making a delivery to her house, mm-hmm. and I knew about Black Pete, and I knew about the sort of fraught history of that in, you know, the people in blackface in Amsterdam, and that really does go back quite a ways, And I had this character who was a World War II vet who could sort of explain what Black Pete was and would have had the experience. I looked it up, they actually did have the Christmas celebration after the end of World War II. So if you were in occupied Netherlands at the end of World War II and you were a black soldier, you would suddenly have seen all these guys in blackface out on the street at Christmas time and would have been wondering, what the heck is this? So
so remind me as we jump forward, in the book, we didn't lose any major protagonists.
No, I didn't want to kill anybody off. Right. It was because, again, my theme of the book was survival. And so right. I made you think that people might die, but in the end, they all made it through.
Right. In the show, we just spoke about the fact that we lost Ruby.
George dies early on.
George dies early on, which was heartbreaking for me. Because, again, as a black sci-fi geek, you know, I really identified with George as someone that I could see in my life introducing that interest to me, mm-hmm. right? So it was almost like a figure, an uncle figure, a father figure for me, as having someone pass down something that is so celebrated and wonderful. And I just thought as a leader that the group would really rely on, certainly as in the book, would rely on his leadership to help get them through this stuff. So we lose Uncle George early on, we lose Ruby, and then we lose Atticus in the final, which
I did not see coming. Really, I would have thought that he was untouchable, but that, again, that is one of the few cases where my own preconceptions faked me out, because mm-hmm. I just, you know, there were, if I were going to kill off characters in the novel, he and Letitia were basically off the table, and I would have assumed that would be the case in the series as well. So
yes. I mean,
that Misha Green, she is not afraid to
what a better way to move forward with this series than to have this sort of power couple to tell a right. love story and action and sci-fi and horror story at the same time. This is what I was envisioning as they went forward. Mm-hmm. But it looks like they're going in a different direction. And that is a more female-centric,
right.
Superhero kind of storytelling, right? So it looks like at the very end, those that have survived, obviously Letty, who Journey Smollett just really brought to life on screen.
She was amazing. She was
amazing in that. So we have her as the probably the central character that the story is going to be built around. Hippolyta, who, as we said, is sort of transitioning into Orinthia Blue.
Yeah.
Diana and her badass atomic arm and pet Dagoth, which I thought was a really nice touch to the end of that. And then Gia, I think, is going to be a part of that core group moving.
She's going to be there. And then you've got Montrose to watch the kids right. when the women are out saving the world.
Now that's what surprises me, because I struggled with Montrose in this storytelling. I just did not, I never connected with him as a central, important, crucial figure, right? To me, if you were going in that route, that would be Uncle George, I mean, Montrose does not believe, I mean, he believes in obviously the magic stuff, because he's, it's, you know, he's uncovered it, but he's not a sci-fi fan. I mean, it's just, he sort of fought against this stuff along the way. And as a strategic thinker, I don't think outplayed the thinking process of either Atticus or Uncle George early on. I don't know. I think they made a mistake tying this to Montrose as a part of the group.
I mean, I think that part of the reason for the choice is just that because of the relationship he has with Atticus and the difficulty of that, there's just a lot more drama there than where George's job is in the novel is partly to serve as a mediator between Montrose and his son. But he's a character who does not have a ton of flaws that you can see. So that I think if you're going to kill one of them off, it makes perfect sense that you get rid of George, because there's more dramatic potential in Montrose, even if he is not necessarily the person you'd want in charge of things in real life. Yes, I agree with you. If I wanted a strategic center, I would have picked George as well, because he's just a lot more stable in certain ways. But and particularly the way the series interpreted Montrose, whereas in the novel, the Montrose's main issue, I think, is just that given the way his own father is murdered, he's hard to take, because he's unlike most modern fathers. Montrose does not care whether his son likes him. It's like, it's not my job to be Atticus's friend. My job is to keep him alive and teach him not to do stupid things that will get him killed. Mm-hmm. And if I've got to smack him around to get him to see sense, I will smack him around to get him to see sense. And that has a logic of its own that makes sense. And it's not about the really difficult self-hatred that Montrose is wrestling with in the series. So,
and I suppose if you're going to move forward with a female-centric cast of characters and heroes, you don't really need a man leading the strategic vision for this group.
That would be a thing that would be kind of odd. And this way they can also be agents. I mean, I'm sure there will be more romance. I'm sure that that's another reason, of course, to get rid of George and Atticus, is that Hippolyta can have new romance, Letitia can have new romance,
I just think people are
first
of all, just even the name Letty and Tick, right? I mean, that is something I saw going for a long time. We talked a little bit about Montrose. Rewind 1921 was an exceptional episode, in that we go back in time and we get that backstory and we get to understand a little bit more about Montrose. This is not the character that you tell in the book, though, but in order for us, I guess, to understand the demons that he struggled with, we had to jump back in time to get a little bit of that backstory. In the novel, he's not gay, right?
No, not at all.
And then they introduce, so as we get to understand that part of his history, they introduce this thing that where Uncle George might actually be Atticus' father. Do we know that for sure? Did they make that clear?
No, they equivocated on that, but so you never know for sure. But what was interesting to me about the Rewind 1921 is that it parallels the Narrow House, which is the chapter in the novel where Atticus tells the story of, where Montrose tells the story of Tulsa, and it has the same goal, which is basically to explain how Montrose became the kind of father he is. Obviously, it's quite different in the novel. It's just like, why is he so angry all the time, and why is he so hell-bent on protecting Atticus at all costs? And in the series, the payoff is just basically that, I sacrificed all of this. Like, I may not be your biological father, but every sacrifice I made of my own identity was to bring you into existence. So this is what, and that, of course, also sets up Atticus's own sacrifice in the final episode, which and this was again a thing I had to watch a couple times to get what they were doing, but it works. And it does justify Atticus's death, as painful as that was for me, and I think for other viewers as well. And we would all love to have Letitia and Atticus ride off into the sunset together, and that is not apparently in the cards.
I am I'm a hopeless romantic. That's what I was hoping for. So we move forward. Letty is pregnant with Atticus's child. So that, I guess, will be an important part of the storytelling. To end this thing, I'm going to ask you to do something that's probably impossible. I'm HBO, and I'm coming to you based on the way that ended. and asking you to write me a storyline for next season, what would you put together? I mean, you must have at the end of the show sort of imagined how you would tell the story from that point forward.
Well, actually, this is the interesting thing, is that I do have plenty of ideas of what to do next, but what I have ideas of what to do next is in the world of the novel. And I have been sort of wrestling with the idea, because I'm not generally a sequel person, but since I finished writing this book, I've still been thinking about these characters. So I want to go back and write more books and stick in my, and what I love is the idea that even the series introduced the idea of parallel universes and multiverses. And so over in the rough multiverse where, you know, George and Ruby and Atticus are all still alive, I've got plenty of ideas of what comes next there. I think in the world of the HBO series, I'm going to continue my wise choice at the beginning of season one, where I basically told Misha, you know, I trust you to do what you want and know what you want. So take what you want from my novel and leave the rest, and you do your thing. And that's what I would say to HBO probably, is like, if Misha wants my input or wants some, you know, additional ideas, I'm happy to give them to her, but you should really trust her to know where she's going and to know what to do next. And I'm going to be over here with my guys seeing where I go. And, you know, we'll see, maybe there can be some cross-pollination of ideas, maybe not, but
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Do you think you can continue to write the book without the show sort of subliminally impacting your storytelling?
Well, definitely after that finale. Yeah. That was one of the things. It was funny watching the show, like worrying that they, you know, because that there are bits of business that you're sort of thinking about in the back of your head. Like, I had thought at one point that it would be interesting to, in my own version of the story, to eventually send Montrose physically back to Tulsa, not to, you know, like find the Book of Names, which is not there, but rather to find out the identity of the white man who killed his father, because his father is killed in it's essentially a drive-by shooting on the opening night of the Tulsa massacre. And I had thought about having Braithwaite, you know, tease him with the possibility of finding the responsible party by a form of time travel. And even though that's a different, the way I was going to do that is a different mechanism than what they did in the show, at this point, it's close enough that I don't think I would do that in the same way. So there is a sense in which, I don't want to repeat anything they do in the show. And I also don't want to steal Misha's thunder, but the fact that the storylines have diverged so much, I think means that won't be as much of an issue. And, and I do like the idea of a proof of concept that you can have two versions of the story proceeding simultaneously, because I don't think I've ever seen anything done quite that way before. And so again, this is all provisional. I don't know. I haven't yet had the discussion with my publisher and my agent about this. And Misha's still in negotiations with HBO about whether there will be a season two. So we don't know whether either storyline will continue forward, but it'll be interesting if they both do.
Yeah. I mean, you left pretty much all your characters intact, so you can continue. Even Braithwaite is still alive. Is Braithwaite black in Indiana? Did they turn him black and leave him in Indiana, or they just left him in Indiana?
No. They just made it impossible for him to. No, they changed the in the book. It's the mark of Cain is this tattoo on his chest that gives him immunity, and they alter it so that he still has immunity, but he also is banished from certain places. Like and again, it's like being banished from Eden. But in his case, he can't come back to Chicago and certain other parts of the country.
Right.
He still has most of the U.S. to wander around in.
Okay.
And so the trick will be, how will he find his way back in? But no, he's still very much a white man.
Right. Okay. Because they were laughing at the end. I was wondering. I said, wow, did they like leave him black and have a police officer roll up on him and
oh no, the mark of Cain being black skin, that is a racist idea. No, the mark of Cain is definitely not that.
Hey man, I really appreciate you coming on again and helping us digest the show, introducing your book to those that may not have read it, and introducing book readers to those that haven't seen the show. I think it's all very interesting stuff. It'll be extremely interesting to see where HBO goes with this, and I can't wait to see if you come out with another novel of Lovecraft Country.
I will, fingers crossed. We'll see where all this goes. But thank you very much for having me. It's been fun to chat.
There is no official word on a second season as of this recording date, but I can't wait to see where the show and its core group of badass women takes us next. Fingers crossed that there will be another season. Pop Life is a product of WAER Syracuse Public Media. Get archived shows at WAER.org and subscribe to the show for future episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Our producer is Kevin Kloss. I'm Joe Lee. Thanks for listening. Run to the rock. Please tie me. Run to the rock.